Welcome back to the Fifth Estate podcast from the Wheeler Centre. For this week's episode on medicine and healthcare in Australia, we're joined by Sir Gustav Nossal and Dr. Ranjana Srivastava. Here's our host, Sally Warhaft.
It is just an enormous pleasure tonight to be here with our two guests to have a conversation about medicine, about healthcare with these two remarkable people. Ranjana Srivastava is an oncologist, a Fulbright scholar, a columnist for The Guardian, and the author of numerous books, including Tell Me the Truth, Dying for a Chat, What It Takes to Be a Doctor, and A Better Death, Conversations about the Art of Living and Dying Well. She is the recipient of the Human Rights Literature Prize and a Medal of the Order of Australia. Sir Gustav Nossal, there's a bit of an insistence on Gus. As uneasy as I find that, I will call you Gus because you've told me to, but in my being, I'm Sir Gustaffing. An immunologist, former director of Melbourne's Walter and Eliza Hall Institute for decades, a great servant of the World Health Organization, and in more recent years, he's worked with the Children's Global Alliance Vaccine Program for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He has a Companion of the Order of Australia, a former Australian of the Year, one of our 100 living national treasures, and I think the only guest I've ever had on the Fifth Estate who has been on a postage stamp. Please welcome Gus and Ranjana. You might have heard as you were walking in, we were playing a bit of Franz Schubert, a piece called... Can you say it in German beautifully with the...
Well, of course, being an Austrian, why wouldn't I adore Franz Schubert? I mean, Schubert and Mozart are the two heroes of the musical scene in Austria. Franz Schubert wrote this long tome poem called The Winterreise.
This is it.
It's all for voice, and it's sung without interval. It lasts nearly an hour.
Well, that's going to be the same as our conversation, without interval. And I put that on because I had seen somewhere that Gus liked that music. But it also, I got thinking about Schubert, who died in 1828 at the age of 31. And there's a bit of debate about whether he died of typhoid or syphilis. The official version was typhoid. But I thought for some historical perspective to begin our conversation that both of these diseases, typhoid and syphilis, they're infectious diseases. These days, of course, they're very, very easy to treat. But in fact, in Australia, both of these diseases still exist. And I thought we could begin with a bit of a conversation about what medical advancement actually means, because it is not a straight line. Gus, I might throw it to you first.
Well, you're absolutely right. There are major discontinuities, and while there is steady progress, I would highlight in the context of these two great geniuses that the conquest of infectious diseases stands as one of the really pivotal things in the history of medicine. And if you want to say, okay, where actually with the demarcation point, well, it's hard to go past Florey and the discovery of penicillin, the first and still one of the best of the antibiotics. That is a true revolution in medicine.
We'll come back to that. What about for you?
So I think, you know, good evening, everyone, first of all. Pivoting to oncology, I think there was such a long period of time where not much seemed to happen in oncology, and it was actually a fairly primitive profession for quite some time. And I remember I've been an oncologist for only 20 years or so. And even in that time, it's quite astonishing to see how much has changed. And you know, I remember being a a registrar with some of my older consultants, and they would say things like, we used to have to sedate people in order to give them chemotherapy because we didn't have good agents for nausea and vomiting. Now, that was unthinkable to me, to have to sedate someone. And how much, you know, today, and maybe we'll talk about it later, but the advent of immunotherapy, all of a sudden, we are at a point in oncology where there is just an abundance of riches. Not everything works very well, but certainly these days we have so much choice. And so after a long period of a drought in terms of what the public could see, and obviously there's always activity going around behind the scenes, things have just exploded.
Mm. You mentioned that in point of fact, these diseases such as syphilis and typhoid are still with us. And of course, that brings up an enormously important point of the social determinants of health and, in fact, the geographic spread of the wonderful healthcare that we do enjoy in this country. There are plenty of third world nations in which the healthcare is still greatly suboptimal. And even here in Australia, where we have Medicare and where theoretically healthcare should be free, it is an unfortunate fact that many people in the lower socioeconomic classes do not access the services that are available for whatever reason. And so there are social determinants of health as well as just these physical ones.
In fact, what you bring up, the syphilis is really prevalent in some Indigenous communities. And I read there were at least 6 deaths of babies from congenital syphilis in Australia since 2011. In that same period of time, more than 2,100 cases of syphilis, which made me think precisely about what you've just said, that if this was happening in a different demographic, say in Melbourne, it would be treated differently. So what's happening there that we can have babies dying of this disease? Yes.
Well, of course, Indigenous health and the gap in life expectancy between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians is nothing less than a disgrace. And interestingly enough, it's not for want of money being poured into it. There's a lot of money going into this. It has to do with access, it has to do with perceptions, it fundamentally has to do with the fact that we are not making our healthcare system sufficiently attractive to the norms of Aboriginal people, particularly remote Indigenous tribal Aboriginal people. It's a big problem there.
Tell us more, though, then, about what could be done, because you've spent a lot of time on this.
Look, it is very hard because, of course, it is part and parcel of the whole spectrum of disadvantage. I actually don't think of health as a sequestered individual thing. I think it is part of the problem, in this case, of not exactly poverty, but lack of education, lack of opportunity, lack of capacity to join the mainstream in accessing the services that are freely available. Now, in oncology, I don't know how it is, but I imagine the same would be true.
Well, I think you make a good point. And, you know, healthcare can never be viewed in isolation. And it is so intrinsically related to literacy, empowerment, to female empowerment in particular, because childhood health, maternal health stems so much from maternal education. And you know, one of the frustrations I think of working in any health system is you try to fix an illness, but you can't fix the underlying determinants of why that illness occurs in the first place. And that, I think, requires a very different approach to healthcare than somebody is sick, what medicine do we give them?
Let's go back to Howard Florey, who you brought up just a few minutes ago. He, of course, shared the 1945 Nobel Peace Prize for his role in developing penicillin. You were 37 when he died, I think, if my arithmetic is
right. Well, I was born in 31, yeah. So if he died in 68, would that be right?
Well, let's hope so. It would be it'd be stunning if it is right, frankly, which is why I never went to medical school. But did you meet him?
I did meet Florey. As a matter of fact, the circumstances of my meeting Florey were quite interesting because for reasons that are totally trivial, there was a little temporary contretemps between the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute and its close neighbour, the Howard Florey Institute. And in what happened, I was certainly partly at fault. And anyhow, there was a coolness. And one day, not Dick Denton, who was the director of the Florey, but his boss, Pansy Wright, the professor of pathology, rang me up and he said, Gus, I'd like to talk to you. Could you come over and see me? He was a gruff old chap, very daunting sort of a fellow. And I said, I'm for it. And when I got over, he said, Gus, I've brought you over because I want you to meet Florey. So it was quite the opposite of what I'd thought, and we had a very pleasant, rather formal kind of occasion. Florey was quite a formal person. He's not a hail fellow, well-met type at all.
Right.
Neither was my boss, Mac Burnett. They were rather formal people in those days.
So tell us about, what happened with Florey and penicillin, the circumstances that allowed that to happen, and particularly that enabled an Australian to be a part of it?
Well, of course, he was an Australian, but he was working in Oxford. There wasn't very much medical research in Australia in the 1930s when this work was done. But the circumstances were very straightforward. Fleming had actually discovered penicillin just as what you might call a test tube phenomenon. He had noticed that it was a serendipitous finding that there was a culture plate, a little round dish, on which bacteria had been seeded, were supposed to grow. But fortuitously, a mould had floated onto the dish, and had given out, as it turned out, it was a penicillium mould, had made penicillin move into the culture plate, and there was this little semicircle of non-growth emanating from the mould. And anyone else might have said, oh, mouldy plate, let's throw it in the dustbin. Florey was sensible enough not to do that and said, oh, let's figure out what this was. And then came upon Fleming's paper. The fact of the matter was, Fleming invented penicillin, Florey made penicillin into a clinical reality. That's how it worked out. And Florey had very good associates too, who should share in the credit.
Since that time, Ranjana, you go first with this. What would you say has been the most significant advancement in public health since penicillin?
So I think, the antibiotics, obviously, the concept of hygiene, so, keeping, so from sterilisation and sterilisation of equipment to hand hygiene, etc., I think there have been very significant public health initiatives. Vaccination, and it is indeed very sad as a physician to see the anti-vaccination movement that has gained such a stronghold around the world, and it's really devastating that diseases that one might have thought conquered and childhood illnesses like measles, for example, that cause such tragedy around the world, and then there are outcroppings of anti-vaccination around the world.
How dangerous is it?
Oh, incredibly dangerous. I think it's very difficult sometimes for rational scientific people to also, and doctors, I think, to see the outcomes of people with measles or, you know, vaccine-preventable diseases. And you know, especially in my world of oncology, where my chemotherapy patients with reduced immunity are exposed to people with infections with you know, devastating and sometimes fatal consequences. So you know, great impact. So I think vaccination is a you know, a great public health measure. I think, you know, when we talk about how we are living longer, so I think the conquest or at least control of cardiovascular diseases has been a really important point on our medical map. So cardiovascular mortality is decreasing and you see people living longer because they're not dying of infections. Mm-hmm. And of cardiovascular diseases, strokes, for example, etc., heart disease. And so, you know, there are pretty impressive gains in the medical system who, you know, childbirth is another example. So safer childbirth. And, you know, I would completely agree that the healthcare of our indigenous population is really a blot on our otherwise very highly regarded healthcare system.
It's noticeable to me that oncology is absent from quite a wide-ranging answer to that question.
So I think, you know, in the last few years, I think oncology has really occupied the world stage like never before. But really, up until several years ago, and, you know, the progress of oncology has been quite gradual, sort of, and sometimes difficult to notice on a bigger population basis. But you know, lung cancer mortality is coming down. Partly, a lot has to do with the reduction in smoking, but also we have better drugs. Similarly, with many cancers, so you know, now a person who is diagnosed with cancer today has a very high sort of two-thirds or more chance of living for 5 years and beyond. And I know that people listen to that sometimes and say, well, 5 years doesn't sound like a lot of time, but for every year that you survive, your prospects become better. So they are actually impressive figures. Childhood cancers, something that I think really sort of pains us all to think about even or talk about. But, you know, for some diseases like acute leukemia in children, the survival rates are really impressive. In fact, I was looking at a graph just yesterday. One of the pediatricians was talking to us. And you come from a very low bar to now sort of kids really doing well and thriving.
Ranjana, Sally told us before that she thought medical progress was discontinuous. I think in this case of oncology, we have really both. We have discontinuities indeed, but we also have, as you said, this steady march forward. The results of chemotherapy are getting better every year. And now we're able, in some cancers at least, to add immunotherapy as a new weapon. So I think the progress has been extremely heartening. I mean, when I compare what was like when I was a resident to what it is today, it is literally like chalk and cheese. Mm-hmm. And the cancer sufferer, as you say, has a very sporting chance these days. I expect this will continue.
How would you answer the question about the, you know, the greatest achievement in the, you know, in more recent decades, I suppose, since...
Well, of course, Ranjan has already mentioned it. I can't go past vaccines. And that actually brings up a point which I think we should make very strongly to this audience. Unfortunately, most of the publicity in health is directed to what doctors do for and to sick people, the treatment of actual diseases. Equally important, in some respects far more important, is prevention. And I read the other day that I've got the name of the guy in my pocket, but it doesn't really matter. A particular person from Victoria University, I think his name was Harris, said we only spend 1.3% of our health dollar on prevention. Now, I don't know if that's true, but if it's true, it's really shocking. And I can say, well, there's, you know, the general practitioner in particular has such a pivotal role to play in the prevention of common ailments. You know, to try to get onto obesity before it becomes a total health problem. To do something about the 15th percentile of adults who still smoke, and in particular, to stop the young people from smoking. There are so many things that you can do in that preventive field which are not only cheaper than cure, they're also a hell of a lot better.
And I think, you know, the reason that as a society we and as a medical profession we have been slow to catch up with preventative measures is because for the most part we have been trying to avoid mortality and sort of treat diseases. And it's not until the last sort of a couple of decades where we have now got, you know, diseases of lifestyle. This isn't a term that I was taught in medical school in the 90s, you know, lifestyle disease. This is quite relatively recent, very new, in fact. Yes. And so I think all of us are grappling with an age of plenty, suddenly, where malnutrition is not an issue and availability of drugs is not an issue, at least in you know, wealthier countries. And we are now suffering from an embarrassment of riches and we have diseases of excess. And I spent so much of my time talking to people, even my cancer patients, about the importance of diet and exercise and, yeah, and movement. And it really takes a paradigm shift, both from a doctor's perspective as well as a patient's perspective, to think of that as important and as you say, perhaps more important than the drugs we can prescribe.
And unfortunately, the remuneration patterns in healthcare don't aid what you're advocating, because doctors are paid on a case-by-case basis, sometimes to try to get a patient to understand the importance of something like obesity. It takes time. And, you know, a short 15-minute consultation won't do it. I think we should be more flexible in our remuneration patterns to allow for a more profound engagement of the GP with the patient when opportunity dictates.
Well, one of the biggest cultural shifts in the last, what, say, 30 years also is that we no longer have a family doctor in the way that we used to, that perhaps new generations of a family and a doctor that would, like Florey noted, or the mould was noticed in the bowl, a good GP will notice that a patient that she or he knows well is a funny colour.
Yes.
Or is just not themselves. And that relationship, now we go to whatever doctor can fit us in, wherever we are, often.
Sally, you've highlighted what I think is one of the real problems in modern medicine. We have wonderful specialists. They know an awful lot about their own particular disease. We have few generalists. And we need particularly that GP, who I think is the absolute linchpin of the Australian health system. We need that GP to be a generalist, to look at the whole patient, to use the consultants by all means for the detailed treatment of some malady if it's diagnosed, which might be very rapidly changing. You couldn't expect the GP to keep on top of every single new drug in oncology, for example. But that generalist who looks at the whole person, that seems to me to be vitally important and vanishingly rare.
And widely acknowledged. I mean, I remember something in a budget recently, I can't remember when exactly, but where basically GPs were going to get a pay rise and there was a lot of widespread support. And yet a political party that offers, you know, free cancer treatment doesn't get elected. I find that quite interesting, that there is some sort of yearning in Australia for the general practitioner to perhaps be more like it was in the past rather than today.
Yeah, so you know, it's almost romantic to hear these days of a GP who delivered a child and looks after that person in adolescence and an adult, and then delivers that girl's child, and so on. I mean, when I it's so rare to hear that. So here's kind of my take on this whole specialist generalist divide. I think that it's incredibly troubling and will come back to really hurt us. It is very common these days for a doctor to have a specialist, a patient to have a doctor for an organ, and nobody to put the whole person together. And so, you know, you have the nephrologist and the cardiologist and the infectious diseases doctor and the oncologist and so on. And it's actually really troubling because the patient gets lost. Doctors don't communicate too well either. And so, you know, the patient becomes the unfortunate and the hapless linchpin who has to connect all the doctors together. So, you know, why does this happen? When all of us realize that we need good generalists and the primacy of the general practitioner needs to be established in the community, why doesn't this happen? So my take on this, and I'm happy to hear other views, is a couple of things. I think as a society, we still lionize niche specialists over everybody else. And I think we don't credit generalists enough. And the number of times that I am still asked, you know, are you just a GP? I think that is so insulting to general practitioners, and yet that's what we do. You are just a GP. So you are automatically, to a group of students who are studying medicine or to kids who want to become doctors, and we see this, they come to open days and they say, 12-year-old kids say, how do I become a brain surgeon? Yeah. How do I become an author? And, you know, mum and dad are standing in the back nodding away. So I think...
Is that particularly Australian thing?
Well, no, it's not. And in America, for example, the reason behind a lot of people leaving generalist practice and general medicine and wanting to become a specialist is that they are submerged in so much debt and that they need to pay back their debts. And, you know, a general internist or a general practitioner doesn't make nearly as much income as somebody who is a super specialist, who knows one part of the body, knows it really well, but unfortunately is not able to put the whole person together often. So I think, you know, we also create this problem, and we will continue to create this problem if we have an attitude about, you know, valuing niche surgeons or specialists or, you know, oncologists of the left lung, so on. And yet we talk about the fact that, you know, we yearn for somebody who knows us as a person.
So if that's done sort of culturally, are there certain areas that are privileged in research and funding and, of course, underprivileged areas?
Well, it's interesting that you should ask that, Sally, because... there's recently by Alan Lopez, who's a guy from Melbourne University, has done a study that's actually measured how much medical research in terms of dollars spent is done on what kind of diseases. And there is a major disconnect between the importance of a disease and the amount of funding that it gets. Now, for example... in the infectious diseases field. Malaria is a good example. Very important, don't let me trivialise malaria, but tremendous funding for malaria. But then compared with pneumonia or genitourinary acute infections, very little funding. So there is a bit of a disconnect. And I don't think there should necessarily be a one-to-one correlation between the amount spent and incidence of disease. But it should be better than it is.
In the field of oncology, I think oncology is obviously very emotive. And there is no doubt, for example, that breast cancer attracts a whole lot more funding than something like cancer of the pancreas or a brain tumour. But I think, you know, what is even more striking, I think, is the lack of investment in supportive care and in palliative care. And really, you know, at the end of the day, we are mortal, no matter what sort of illness we have and you know, access to palliative care, access to good end-of-life care needs a lot more research, needs a lot more investment. And you know, that often misses out because we are always chasing cures and treatments. And you know, if you look into many of the treatments that are approved regularly, and in particular in oncology, there are 50 or 60 drugs each year currently that are being approved by the Food and Drug Administration, and then slowly they're filtered through to here and around the world. Some of them have very minimal effect on survival, if any. But they are touted as the newest and the best. And you know, I often think of the healthcare budget. It is a limited budget. And, you know, equally important is infrastructure and education and so on and all these other things we need to live a good life. And so we do have to be careful about what we spend our money on. But I think end-of-life care, from where I sit, really needs to be better thought of.
I've been... The reason tonight came about, it started off with I've just been thinking a lot lately about what is Australia really good at, and asking people, and just about everyone at some point in the conversation will say, oh, medicine. We're great at medicine. And people will give all sorts of wonderful examples, but they're mostly in the past. And so what are we in Australia really, really good at? Really world class, where the rest of the world would just say, wow, let's really look at what they're doing in this or that area?
Unfortunately, as with most things, there really are statistics on this, and it has to do, for example, with the number of papers written per head of population, and it has to do with the number of times those papers are cited by others. In other words, are they having an influence on the direction of medical research? And the answer is Australia does punch a little above its weight, but it's not by very much. Now, I think we have tended to create a tiny bit of an urban myth here. You know, why should Australian medical researchers be better than Dutch medical researchers? Why should Dutch medical researchers be better than Finnish medical researchers? Human brains are dotted around the world a bit like confetti, you know, they're more or less everywhere. So I'm not seeking to do other than to praise Australian medical research. It's very good. There have been some remarkable advances, and let's continue to invest in it, but let's not pretend that it's way out of the ballpark in comparison with other countries. We do a fair bit to contribute to the world capital in this vitally important area.
Is there anything specific where we're, you know, that little bit more, or it's a general... Oh, it's killing me, you know.
I think something's killing
me eventually.
The two areas which have received great prominence are infectious diseases, which we've covered, and oncology, particularly perhaps in the leukemia-style area, blood cancers and that sort of thing. But there's a lot to be proud of. If my late colleague Don Metcalf were here, I could think about the 60 years that he spent working on leukemia and leading the world in many aspects of that vitally important field, with cures in some cases you've mentioned, particularly the childhood leukemias, and very, very good treatment for others, which is continuously improving. But he's only one of many. And when he goes to a conference, he'll be standing beside Yanks and Canadians and not too many people from the developing countries yet, but that in time will come. For example, watch China go. They are really improving their performance in medical research.
So a couple of things. I think it is important to realise that good medicine is a collaborative effort. And you know, in the modern day where you need tens and thousands of patients to prove the efficacy of a drug, Australia is a small country. And so we often contribute to clinical trials and we put patients in, but really to get good drugs that make a meaningful difference, you need lots and lots of people. And hence, you know, we are often part of really important collaborative efforts.
Yes.
Gus is also being very modest. I think one of the outstanding things that the world credits Australia for is the discovery of GCSF.
Yes.
Which is
Don Metcalf.
Granulocyte colony stimulating factor. It's an injection, and it is a very common injection given to people after chemotherapy to boost the production of their white cells because chemotherapy reduces immunity. So the injection, the administration of GCSF has fundamentally changed the experience profoundly of chemotherapy patients who get less sick, who get less fevers. It allows them to have treatment on time and so on. And it was a moment of great pride for me when I was sitting along with some people from Memorial Sloan Kettering a couple of years ago, which is a prominent cancer center in New York. Now, people who work there feel that anything in the world to do with oncology was discovered there. So the fellows sitting with me said, well, you know, GCSF, what, didn't we discover that? And I said, no, actually, you didn't. And they all look at each other and they couldn't believe it. And they said, where are you from? I said, I'm from Australia. And, you know, that was discovered in Australia. And they all looked at each other and went, really? No, I think we discovered it. And then they Googled it and realized I was right. So I think that is something that stands out in my head as something very uniquely Australian.
One of the lovely paradoxes in medical research is that your toughest competitor is, in a way, also your best friend, your greatest collaborator, you know. And I think it's very interesting that you mentioned collaboration. Doug Hilton is the current director of the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute, and the other day he gave a talk about the work of the Institute and so forth. And he's got 1,000 people, something over 1,000 people working in that institute now. But he said, you know, one of the things that we find enormously important is collaboration with our fellow other researchers in Melbourne and beyond. There are so many, as you mentioned before, there are so many specialties and subspecialties. And even a big institute like the Hall Institute, you can't have them all. So reach out, work together, and yes, some people have to get there first, and that's sometimes your first, sometimes someone else's. That person that didn't invent the GCSF might have invented some other hormone quite cleverly. We should collaborate as far as we can and be rivals in a good sense of that word.
One of the many notable things with your tenure there, though, Gus, was that you managed to get so many really outstanding Australians back from overseas to come and work with you. Is that a big factor that, you know, we lose a lot of talent?
Well, look, it was important to me. Here's the way I looked at the question of the young people that we were forming. Medical research is a global endeavour. There's no doubt about that. It's quite important for a young medical researcher, say someone that's done their PhD or that's done a 2 or 3 year postdoc with you, to go out into the wider world, because Australia is a long way away and, you know, we haven't got it all. So usually after a PhD finished at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute, they went to the United States, the United Kingdom, occasionally another lab in Europe, very, very rarely a lab somewhere else, say in Asia. And then they had their 2, 3, 4, 5 years there. But I think it's so important to get those people back again and then bring the fruits of what they've learned overseas and pass it on in their turn to their students and their younger people. Very dynamic. And you're kind to allude to it. It is true that the Hall Institute has been a little bit of a focal point for returning Australians, not just the ones that we sent out, but that others have sent out. I think it's very important to make career opportunities for them, because that too is a tough and competitive world to try and get a foothold, an actual job in medical research rather than just a studentship or a postdoc. Real jobs, pretty hard to come by.
What about the way we teach medicine in Australia? My father's a retired anaesthetist. I remember him telling me when I was little that medical school basically, you know, they used to spend like a week on the wrist to the elbow and then a week on the elbow to the shoulder and a week on the kidneys, and, you know, you'd get to the end of your degree and you'd know about the human body. It's not like that anymore, is it?
No, it's just 3D printing virtual reality.
So has that changed the kind of person that becomes a doctor?
You know, the first thing is, I think the challenge of teaching a medical course today is absolutely enormous because knowledge has exploded. And there is an endless amount of stuff that you need to teach people. It's no longer contained in a book. You know, there is, and knowledge is just exploding very fast. So I think, you know, I talk a lot to the people at the faculty of various faculties of medicine, and I think what we still haven't got right is the balance between teaching the science of medicine and the art of medicine. We are realizing that the art of medicine is really, really important. As people are living longer, we need not only to talk to them about interventions, but also about boundaries of care. And I often find that although we are continuing to produce very good technicians and people with academic skills and obviously great academic credentials, we really need to focus on doctors who can be humane and compassionate and human to their patients. And that takes work. It's not an inherent thing. It's a learned skill. I think, you know, communication is a learned skill. And every time you talk to someone from the faculty, they might say, well, the curriculum is so crammed with anatomy and physiology and so on that there is no time to teach about other things that are so important to the patient, though, and important to us as a society. Cost, for example. You know, we go through an entire medical curriculum without ever talking about the cost of medicine, the cost of intervention. How does that happen? If doctors are meant to be gatekeepers of the healthcare budget in some way, and if a doctor has never been taught what healthcare costs, the economics, how do you manage that? So I think we have a long way to go towards getting the course right, and it'll probably move with the times. I don't think there is one right course that will be good for the ages.
It's certainly true that there's an enormous amount to learn, and I think one of the most important things to teach medical students is that the learning goes on for life. You've got to teach the students to constantly, not just graduate, MBBS, do your residency, out in practice, bang, finish. The field is constantly changing, and I think that question of learning for life is very important. It's a long time since I practiced medicine, but I, apart from whatever reading I do in immunology, I think both the Australian Medical Association and the Royal Australasian College of Physicians do a good job. Each of them puts out a journal. And I read that journal religiously. And just that little bit just keeps me a touch abreast. Of course, it's got gaps, but I think that's my type of attempt to keep on learning, even at 88 years of age, and even though I don't touch patients in anger anymore.
We'll go to questions shortly. I want to ask each of you what, you know, really excites you about what's going on in medical research at the moment? What have we got to, you know, really be enthused and passionate about?
Well, what excites me is the young people. Medical research and the discovery part of medical research is a young person's game. They are so much better trained than I was. They are so keen. They're so bright. They're so positive. Yes, there is so much to learn, and yes, there's a desperate struggle to keep on top of everything. But I find the young people, for example, at a place like the Walter and Eliza or the Florey or the Baker, just an absolute joy. Their thrill and discovery and their capacity to mix it with the world's best.
And I think for me, I think what excites me about medicine is the privilege of looking after people. And I think, you know, the research goes on in the background, and so it, you know, it and there are brilliant people doing the research. But for a very, I think, you know, Gus Nossal and I are probably at opposite ends of the medical spectrum, where you are not only an erstwhile clinician, but a brilliant researcher. I have stepped away from research and really spend my life being a clinician. And you know, it's the patient-facing. And it is such a privilege. It is such a privilege to be able to do it well and to make a difference. Yes. And I think, you know, the job of a clinician is to translate brilliant research into how it matters to the individual patient. And so what excites me is being able to have the language to do that. And also, I think, the perspective to know when a certain research applies to an individual and, importantly, when it does not, and how to help people navigate an incredibly complex array of drugs and interventions that we are faced by.
Is there an area of medicine that you think, you know, where the focus is really going to be good in terms of results rather than people, each of you? Like, is it going to be in cancer or hearts or immunology, or where do you think things are looking really particularly exciting?
It's a bit hard to, rank fields against each other, but I'm most excited about the advances in cancer. I think they really have been spectacular. I think my own discipline of immunology is beginning to make small contributions. The potential there is endless. I'm also quite fascinated, as you mentioned, Ranjana, of the tremendously good way in which we treat heart disease these days. Things that were a death sentence a few decades ago are now almost amongst the medical trivia, you know, sticking a few stents into your coronaries and off you go. Mm. So there's a lot of good stuff happening. It's hard to rank one against the other.
If you would like to ask a question, please just wait for a mic to land in your hand. Great.
Oh, thank you so much. It was wonderful. Despite the advances in cancer, I think, as you acknowledge, there's a bit of a problem with both brain and pancreatic cancer. Do you think it's just because they don't have the same appeal to people, or that it's something to do with the nature of the cancers of those organs?
Yeah, thank you for that. I think firstly, you know, cancer is not one disease, and I take pains to explain to people that even something like breast cancer is many different diseases, and different cancers are different diseases. I think there is absolutely an element, and especially in a society like ours that really thrives on often, you know, who speaks the loudest, etc., that publicity has much to do with funding. I would like, in an ideal world, for cancers to be funded equally or at least fairly. I think that, yes, it is probably more, you know, more of us probably know. And breast cancer is very common. And, you know, certainly I think we should all pay credit to the way in which the grassroots organization of breast cancer has managed to do so well and attract so much attention. So, yeah, I think that when cancers affect, when there are rare cancers or they affect smaller numbers in the population, perhaps there is less vocal advocacy. Sometimes medicine feels less excited, so healthcare feels less excited about certain cancers because we haven't been able to make gains. And so I suppose it's human nature to celebrate what you do well and kind of not talk so much about the gains you are not making. So I think there's a whole host of reasons. But, you know, but what's so wonderful about an informed and an educated audience like you is to realize that and to support causes that are not necessarily fashionable, but which yield really, you know, advantages to people who may be less seen.
Hi, I'm an immunologist.
What's your name?
Lynn Corcoran.
There we are.
I'm curious, Gus, about the current divide between people who value vaccination and people who don't, and that it's not a rational argument anymore. It's become such an emotional argument, and that it's us and them, and there's a failure to understand the miracle that vaccination has been as a medicine. So how do you think we go forward to bring people together again?
Well, vaccines are really, in a funny sort of way, the victims or the prisoners of their own success. Interestingly enough, as I travel around the developing countries, there is very little by way of anti-vaxxers. You know, they can see when the polio vaccine comes around, or the vaccine that was able to get rid of smallpox. It used to kill 2 to 3 million people per year. Now it's gone completely. So in the developing countries where infectious diseases are more rife, you don't get this anti-vaccination appeal. It is true that many of the vaccines that we get now are for diseases which are uncommon. They're now uncommon. Why are they uncommon? Because of vaccines. So if someone takes it upon themselves to be an anti-vaxxer and not to have their children immunised, and not to be immunised themselves, A, they're taking a risk, because when they travel, they may well go to a country where those diseases are still rife. And B, they're being very selfish, because they get away with it because of the fact that the other 90% or 92 or 3%, as it is in Australia now, have been vaccinated. So it's an interesting argument. Fortunately, serious vaccine side effects, I'm not speaking about a sore arm or a little sore lump under your armpit, that's trivial, but serious vaccine side effects are quite rare. They're not non-existent, but they're in the sort of one in a million style situation. So the side effects should not stop people from having their kids vaccinated.
The government response in Australia has been pretty fantastic, is my impression. You know, if your kid's not vaccinated, they can't go to childcare and that sort of thing, which I've always thought politically strange. I mean, I totally back it. But why people, the governments can see the science there but say not on climate change. We don't expect, say, the ABC to have balance with an anti-vaxxer, for example.
That's right.
They've been pretty great on, that's right, on vaccinations. So.
Well, it's interesting. We did... the system is responsive. When you get your normal DPT as a young person, diphtheria, pertussis, which is whooping cough, and tetanus, the pertussis, the whooping cough component of that, which consisted in the past of whole killed bacteria, was what we call rather reactogenic. A reasonable proportion of people got quite a sore arm, and a small proportion of people got a fever. Some, rarely, but some even convulsed. So we took it on board that those side effects are really not acceptable. So we've now got an acellular pertussis vaccine, which consists purely of the molecules from that bacterium, which are protective, and not of the whole bacterial body. But there is a but. But the vaccine isn't quite as strong. So it doesn't last quite as long. And theoretically, we should all be having boosters every 10 or 20 years, but we don't. One of the things that is noteworthy now is that some people, few people, very few people, but some people have had the pertussis vaccine actually get whooping cough, although it would be very mild because they're partially protected. Again, with the measles vaccine, which is an excellent vaccine, which in Australia we give as part of MMR, measles, mumps and rubella, or German measles, excellent vaccine, but it's not 100% protective. So a few vaccinated kids get measles. Fortunately, it is usually quite, quite mild, with the rash and none of the complications that can follow on measles. But look, it's not a perfect world, and vaccines aren't perfect.
Thank you very much for your talk. I'm afraid I'm going to be a bit of a party pooper because I'm passionate about the woeful neglect of the patients in the our hospital system with cognitive impairment, delirium, dementia, both the experience in hospital and the poor outcomes, which result from the model of care in our acute hospitals not being suited to people with dementia, and cognitive impairment, delirium and what have you, both from a professional and personal experience. And I know in England, the author, Nikki French, who was recently had a bad experience with her father, has now started a campaign.
I'm going to need you to frame model. This into a question,
right,
please.
Okay. So who is in Australia is going to take up the baton and the voice for people with cognitive impairment and look at improving the experience and outcome for our in our hospital system, because this is an area of disease where there's going to be, with an ageing population, a huge increase.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for your question. And I would agree with you that people with cognitive impairment are poorly served in the healthcare system overall. I think it's a multifactorial thing. Education about looking after people who are cognitively impaired has been historically quite poor. We haven't dealt with this, you know, this tsunami of aged residents and people from aged care, and an aging population, as you say, is being visited upon us in recent times. And like many other things, we are still catching up with what that means. I think better training is required, better education is required, but also I think better advocacy from all of us for people who have family members with cognitive impairment, patients with cognitive impairment, which means better understanding. It means being patient towards these people, because they do require more time, more attention, and in a society which is increasingly based on, you know, haste and busyness, I think we need to pause. And that's difficult. That's difficult for us. And I certainly, as an acute hospital doctor, I have countless examples of relatives and family members who also feel impatient and who expect doctors and the healthcare system to solve the issue when it's really a societal issue. And we have to tackle this together. So definitely needs better public health engagement, needs better policy, but it's not going to be, unfortunately, I don't think, one thing or one policy or one group that can fix the problem that is approaching us of people living longer lives and being cognitively impaired.
Dementia is certainly a tremendously important problem. The three common causes of dementia are vascular dementia, Lewy body dementia, and Alzheimer's. And of those, Alzheimer's numerically is by far the most important. Now, I've got good news and bad news for you. If the Alzheimer's dementia is really due to those protein amyloid plaques which are deposited in the brain, potentially we could prevent it. The bad news is that if we were going to do that, we'd have to start about 20 years before the symptoms are manifest. In other words, we'd better have something that is incredibly, incredibly safe. But there are mouse models of Alzheimer's where it's been clearly shown that antibodies to the amyloid protein can cause it to be sequestered and not deposited in the brain. So potentially, and I'm speaking now very long term, potentially there is a preventative pathway.
Our time is up. It is just flown, and I'm so sorry that we have to wind it up, because I know there's so many more things that we could talk about. It's been an absolute just a pleasure and a privilege tonight to have you both here. Thank you both.
Gustav Nossel, Ranjana Srivastava and Sally Warhaft, recorded in front of a live audience on Tuesday the 2nd of July 2019. This series comes to you via the Wheeler Centre, Melbourne's home for conversations about books, writing and ideas. Check us out at wheelercentre.com. Until next time, take care.